totally okay and nothing to be embarrassed or feel a bit of shame about if you don't like veggies, especially if you haven't grown up with them, or it's something that's sort of like you're looking to introduce more new into your diet, because as you said, the texture, the taste can be very different to all of these hyper palatable foods such as Pop-Tarts and instant macaroni and cheese and things that are on the market that don't have any of these ingredients or textures or flavors. So it's no surprise that you don't like it. So
yeah, it's not your fault is what we're saying as well.
Hi, I'm Claire Goodwin and this is the PCOS Nutritionist Podcast. I have PCOS too and I know how hard it can be to get the help you need. So I bring together my expertise as a registered nutritionist and exercise scientist, together with other experts I trust and people with real life lived experience of PCOS, to help you get the information you need to make a real difference to your symptoms. Now, if you've been struggling with PCOS, working with us might just be the game changer you've been looking for. You see, PCOS is a complex hormonal disorder that can affect everything from your menstrual cycle to your fertility to your mental health. And while medication can be helpful in managing some of the symptoms of PCOS, it's often not enough on its own. That's where a lifestyle change comes in. We take a holistic approach to PCOS, looking at everything from your diet to your stress levels to your sleep habits, and create a personalized plan that works for you. We'll help you make lifestyle changes that can reduce your symptoms, improve your fertility, and boost your overall well-being. Whether you're struggling with weight gain, acne, or mood swings, we'll work with you to develop a plan that's tailored to your unique needs and goals. And the best part? We'll be with you every step of the way, providing support, accountability, and guidance as you navigate your PCOS journey. We have both our fully supported 12-week program, the PCOS Protocol, or you can book one-on-one appointments with myself, Claire, or one of our other qualified nutritionists. Head to thepcosnutritionist.com to either sign up for the PCOS Protocol or to book a one-on-one appointment. The links are in the show notes. In today's episode, we're going to be talking all about how to eat healthy for PCOS if you don't like vegetables. Now, if this is you, please don't feel embarrassed. This is nothing to be ashamed about. Many of us grow up with different aversions to food or just not having the exposure to vegetables when we're younger. And so naturally, our palate, our preferences don't really include bitter foods like vegetables. Now, when I was growing up, I had a really severe texture aversion to the point where if I tried to eat something with a mushy texture, I would instantly gag. And so I know exactly what it's like to not be able to eat something because your body physically repels it. So I totally get this. So today we'll be giving you all the tips and tricks about how to sneak those vegetables into foods you already like so that you're still getting all of the value from the vegetables, and they are still really important in terms of we'll go into the nutrients, fiber, etc. So it is still really important to get them, but just how to get them in there without being repulsed by them. So today we're going to be talking all about vegetables and how to live a healthy PCOS lifestyle if you don't like vegetables. So first of all, we're going to be discussing why vegetables are important. And I'm sorry to say that, we're still going to be talking about why they're important, but we're going to help you with how to incorporate them even if you don't like them. But we're going to talk about why it's important, because I think that it is good to understand that, and therefore you'll be more motivated to keep going on your journey of liking vegetables. And this is something that a lot of people struggle with. So if this is something that you are struggling with, you are absolutely not alone. We work with so many patients in our PCOS protocol and one-on-one who don't like the taste of vegetables or the texture. It's not just taste, but it can be texture, it can be flavor, it can be the association that they have with vegetables from their childhood. There's lots of different reasons. And so you're definitely not alone, and we have learned a lot of techniques and had a lot of feedback from people as to what works for them that we can help you with. So first of all, let's get into why it's important. So Charlie, we'll start with you. So with PCOS, why do we think that vegetables are important? Like why if a patient comes to us and says, like I'm just thinking of the patient we had last week who said, look, I grew up in a family that did not eat a lot of vegetables. We ate a lot of processed food. I am a product of the generation of parents who were brought up in the kind of industrial boom of the 50s, 60s, and consequently, I grew up eating Pop-Tarts for breakfast, like a lot of kind of like macaroni cheese and stuff for lunch, very processed food and heavy kind of like carbohydrate-y foods. Which are really delicious, you know, like a lot of them are really good. And so it's no wonder that, you know, for her trying to eat something that's a lot more bitter, like some broccoli, wouldn't be as palatable. So what is it that we are still, or why are we still wanting her to incorporate more vegetables?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's important to first of all recognize for this client and anyone else that sort of resonates with this feeling that it's totally okay and nothing to be embarrassed or feel a bit of shame about if you don't like veggies, especially if you haven't grown up with them or it's something that's sort of like you're looking to introduce more new into your diet, because as you said, the texture, the taste can be very different to all of these hyper palatable foods such as Pop-Tarts and instant macaroni and cheese and things that are on the market that don't have any of these ingredients or textures or flavors. So it's no surprise that you don't like it. So
it's not your fault is what we're saying as well. Like that you are a product of how you're brought up, and how you're brought up is often a product of the marketing at the time as well. And at the time that we were brought up, the manufacturing companies pretty much had a free rein of how they wanted to market to us. And so it is no wonder that, you know, the convenience food, we were definitely the children of the convenience food era and the, you know, manufactured food era. So this is something that has been, it's been you have absorbed that rather than you necessarily deciding that when you were a child.
Exactly. So yeah, wanted to first of all start off with that. But vegetables serve so many important reasons and things in our diet. They like provide so many nutrients, so many functions, and can be just an absolute vital addition. So well done if you're here and you're wanting to start adding them in. It doesn't have to be all at once, even just a couple of small things or ways that you can add them in, which we're going to talk about today. But I guess sort of one of the first and most important and helpful beneficial things that vegetables can do in our diet is help providing bulk. So especially from some of our non-starchy veggies, so that's things like leafy greens, broccoli, cauliflower, zucchini, bell peppers or capsicum, just to name a couple off the top of my head, can add some fantastic bulk into our diet, which not only helps keep us full for longer, but it helps keep food moving through our digestive tract, helps keep us regular with going to the bathroom, and can also be really important with helping keep our blood sugar stable, which we know can be challenging for some of us with PCOS that is driven with insulin.
Yeah, and when we talk about bulk, what we're saying here is basically the volume of food, right? Like you look at, we often see these comparisons on Instagram or social media of people who are showing this many calories of like, you know, it's 100 calories of raisins, for example, and 100 calories of fresh grapes, right? They're the same food, but just prepared in a different way. It gives us so much more bulk because you get the water in that. We're not necessarily referring about calories here, but we're referring to the size of the portion of that food. So, you know, you can think about, so 100 calories of raisins would be a tiny little palm, you know, sized amount, whereas 100 calories of grapes would be two, or a massive bowl, basically. And so when we have that much volume of food, that's where it helps us feel fuller, as Charlie said, move our food through our intestines to keep us regular, give us good gut health, all of those things. So that's what we're meaning when we're talking about bulk. If we don't have that bulk, what happens that we generally see?
Like, that's got to be replaced by something, right? Like, to keep us full. Generally, our stomachs and our brain will still want that size of food. It's not that we just are happy with the small, tiny handful of raisins and go, oh, yeah, that was delicious and nourishing, and I don't know what else we might think, but we would go, no, I'm still hungry, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in very simple terms, what happens when we have something we have a meal that's higher in volume or higher in bulk, like we're saying, is our stomach actually stretches, and the stretch in our stomach sends signals to our brain, which tell us that we are full and satisfied, so that our hunger cues can be lowered or turned off, so that we know that we actually are satisfied from that meal. So same with the raisins that you're talking about before, probably not going to get much stomach stretch from that because it's pretty small. Whereas if you are having something like the grapes, the fresh grapes, there is probably going to be a little bit more stretch in comparison, typically from the volume, and that it's just a bigger amount that you'll be chewing and putting in your body, I guess. So
yeah, I think the chewing is a really good one to think about as well, because that starts to send signals to our brain that we are full as well, right? And so the more we're doing that, the more our brain, it gives us our brain the time. I think it's about 20 minutes for that signal to get from our stomach to our brain. And so if, you know, we're thinking about chewing something like a bowl of salad, it takes us quite a while to get through that. And it gives our body time and our brain time to recognize that actually we have had a decent amount of food. Whereas it's very easy to eat the same sort of, you know, you imagine chowing through a bowl of raisins, it would be relatively easy. Or a bowl of fries, you know, might be a more, you know, thing that you would think about. I don't think many people sit down to eat a bowl of raisins, but you could easily sit down to eat a bowl of fries. So if you were going out for dinner, for example, and, you know, you had even like steak, fries and salad, as if you ate the salad and that was like half the plate, then your body is already getting some of that stretch and already getting some of those messages that it's full. Whereas if you didn't have that, you're going to be eating the steak and the fries. You're probably going to eat more of the fries than what you would have if you'd had the salad, because you just need that more bulk to send those signals to your brain. And this is what we see, is that when we don't eat many vegetables, we kind of have to replace that bulk with something else. And often the next bulky thing would be carbohydrates like potatoes, pasta, rice, other things, which can be really good foods, but in those of us with PCOS, most of us, as in 85% of us, have some insulin resistance, which is when our body does not respond normally when we eat carbohydrates. So if we ate, say, you know, that bowl of fries, for someone whose blood sugar and insulin is working well, we might release 20 units of insulin to store all the glucose that's contained in that bowl of fries. And then our glucose is stored, and then our insulin kind of goes about its day. In insulin resistance, our body might have to produce 50 or 60 or 100 units of insulin to do that same job of like processing and storing the blood glucose from that bowl of fries. So effectively what that means, and I think that Lily Nichols did a really good job of explaining this in a recent podcast about gestational diabetes. What it means is that we basically have carbohydrate intolerance. So we can't eat as many carbohydrates as other people without it affecting our blood glucose and our insulin as much. And so we, for those of us with this base insulin resistance and carbohydrate intolerance, replacing vegetables with carbohydrates can be a real big problem, because we just need to have a much bigger portion size to make us feel full, and our bodies can't actually tolerate that bigger portion size. So this is where I see that it becomes the biggest problem in PCOS, is just that we have to replace it with something, and often that something comes from carbohydrates.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, as you said before, there's carbohydrate sources like pasta, rice and things like that can be relatively inexpensive, pretty cheap to buy in bulk as well, easy to make in large quantities. Again, usually pretty hyper-palatable, meaning they're super yum to our taste buds, so it's something that we're going to find moreish and want to eat a lot of. And that's also not something that a lot of people probably get from vegetables. Like, yes, some people love them and they do get that sort of like moreish wanting more, but I think it's these sort of higher sugar and higher salt things like prepackaged macaroni and cheese and stuff like that that does actually make us crave and want these more. And unfortunately, some of these foods aren't as high in fiber as perhaps adding in some veggies would add to our meal. And it's that lower fiber carbohydrate as well, which may give us that volume stretch to begin with, but it doesn't actually sustain us for very long. So unfortunately, in 1.5-2 hours time, maybe even sooner for some of you, you'll probably be hungry again for a host of different reasons. And one is the volume. It's moved through you. It hasn't taken very long to digest and your tummy is empty and ready for a little bit more food again.
Yeah, so true. So fiber is one of those things that we often hear about, but we might not know what it is. But basically it's the stuff in, you know, like if you think about, you take a, like a leaf of spinach or kale, like all those, you look at like all the veins and all of like the stem and, you know, like all of those bits, that's really like fiber, or I don't know, maybe a better word is like roughage, but that's really, your body can't really digest those. Well, it can't digest them. And so when we eat those foods, our body will extract the nutrients that it can. So from spinach, it will extract all of the vitamins and minerals in there, and then the rest of it can't digest, so it'll pass through into our large intestine, and that's what makes up your poo, right? Like, is all of this fiber that your body can't digest, as well as other things. But as you said, Charlie, that's also what helps keep us quite full, because we've still got that kind of bulk in there. Whereas something like pasta, like white, think of just your normal white pasta, which is made from reconstituted flour and water, and that's flour's been basically, if you think about a wheat, like a grain of wheat, it's been pummeled so much that it turns into a white powder, and then we mix it with water and other things to make it into pasta. That there is because in the pummeling process we've actually removed out all of the fiber from that wheat molecule, the wheat grain, and in that process made it really absorbable for our body, which is great, like if we want quick acting food. But the problem is that we actually need the fiber as well, and so that doesn't give us any of that. So yeah, that's the other part of vegetables that is really important.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of reminds me of high school biology. And if you think back, I'm not sure if maybe you remember, and you compare what an animal cell and a plant cell looks like, and it's got that extra cell wall on the outside of the plant wall, plant cell, sorry. And it's that extra cell wall that sort of provides that like roughage and that extra breaking down, and sort of not in a bad way, but in a good way, some more work for our digestive tract to break it down and reduce the cell wall so that we can extract the nutrients out of it and then pass it into our stool or poo, as you said before. Whereas when the pasta, the wheat, has been totally milled down, all of those cell walls have been broken down for us, because it's been completely milled into this tiny, tiny reconstituted flour, which again is great if you're wanting fast-acting carbohydrates, but we're wanting to be satisfied from our meals. We want them to keep us full and give us sustained energy. So
for like 4 hours, not 2 hours, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That is so true. That is such a good analogy. Like, isn't it amazing too what you remember from school biology? Like, I was obsessed with the Punnett squares, which everyone, I always use this analogy, and people say to me, they're like, Claire, no one else remembers this, but it was when you had to work out what color eyes the rabbit was going to have. Like, so you had to, and it's all about like the dominant alleles and recessive alleles. And anyway, that's
the widow's peak. That's what I remember.
That, like, what if you had a blue-eyed rabbit and a green-eyed rabbit, then what's the probability of the babies having like blue eyes and things like that? Anyway, I digress, but like that's probably the only thing that I remember. I hadn't actually thought about the cell walls, but you're right, that was such a good experiment, looking at that under the microscope, and really helps us to think about why foods that have been manufactured and where the machines have done all the work for us and breaking them down, why they move through our body and give us that kind of maybe fast energy, but a fast decline in energy, whereas the things that our body have to break down, just make it a lot more work for our body to do, but that also means that we probably have a lot more sustained energy from that. And yeah, we're really talking about 4 hours here. We want a meal to last us for 4 hours. 3 to 4 hours, I think, is a good amount of time. Anything less than 2, and I'm a bit concerned about that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think quite a good example of that, which you said before as well, like if you think about the spinach or the kale leaves, you can see sort of the fibers and things in there. And sometimes for some people, kale can be actually quite tough on your digestive tract. Mm. And so people say like massage the leaves or just break it down a bit. And what you're doing is breaking down the cell walls just to give your digestive tract a little bit of a head start with breaking it down. But that's sort of how you can actually see it in a real life veggie.
Yeah.
Understand a bit more. Yeah.
So the other thing, so that's, we've kind of talked about the bulk and the fiber, which I think is probably the main one for most people with PCOS. But then there's also probably the biggest other one is all of the nutrients. Like vegetables give us by far the most diversity of like vitamins and minerals and what we call phytonutrients, which is nutrients derived from plants basically. And so we can't really replace a lot of that. We have done an amazing job of extracting a lot of those nutrients and putting them into supplements, which can be really, really helpful in terms of getting more quantity where we need it. So I'm thinking, you know, think something like inositol, which is a compound that works as a insulin messenger and has been found to be really helpful for PCOS. That is really hard to get the amount that we need in food to actually make the difference, right? So there is amazing things that science have done in providing us with the like high doses where we need them. But, oh, and the other one that's been actually quite interesting research on PCOS is a compound called resveratrol. And this is a compound that's in red wine, but I actually looked into this. I think you would have to drink, it was either 300 or 3,000 glasses of red wine to get the amount that we actually needed for to have like a beneficial effect.
Yeah.
So well, like your actual ability to, you know, like get anything from red wine, you know, this is why I wouldn't say to people, oh, you know, just drink some red wine, it's great for PCOS. No, on the whole, the alcohol has a much negative effect. Like you are going to get nowhere near the amount of the actual active ingredient to actually do something helpful in PCOS. So this is where vitamins, minerals can be really helpful, but they cannot replace what nature gives us in vegetables, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think a good way to think of it is that if we're going to the whole source, so like fruits and vegetables, it's much more bioavailable to our body. So that means that our body is much more able to digest and these nutrients are more available. So meaning we can extract them from the fruits and veggies much easier than we can from some supplements. And especially if they are synthetic made nutrients as well. So sometimes, especially in like practitioner brand, and if you are able and you have the means to spend a little bit more on your supplements, you potentially have more bioavailability of your nutrients. But if you're just buying a multi from the supermarket, unfortunately a lot of those are synthetic and aren't very bioavailable. So you might think that you're getting a fantastic dose, but what your body can actually break down and utilize from that is much lower. So you could be happily thinking your mac and cheese and everything is totally fine because you've got your multi-nutrient, but what are you actually taking from that?
Yeah, and this is one where we talked a bit about some different examples of this on recent podcasts. I'm thinking vitamin A with Lily Nichols. We talked there about the difference between something called beta-carotene and retinol palmitate. So basically, your body can absorb retinol palmitate much better than what it can beta carotene. And also our genes vary wildly in how much we can absorb from these foods as well. So same thing with folic acid, which is the man-made version of folate. our body actually has to go through quite a complex conversion process to get folic acid into folate, and not all of us have the genetic makeup that allows that to happen very effectively. So whereas if we're getting folate from our like leafy green vegetables, then it's in the form that our body can actually utilize. So those are kind of some of the examples of that bioavailability. Other ones would be like, I'm thinking magnesium. So some, like a lot of the cheaper brands of magnesium are not very bioavailable and will just literally make you get diarrhea, which can be really helpful for some people who struggle with constipation.
Definitely want to check the form.
Yeah, you definitely want to check the form. So this is something that you, like magnesium, I think is a fantastic vitamin, and a lot of people don't get as much as what they need, and so supplementing with that, but also as much as we can get from our food as possible as well, is a good idea. The other thing is that vitamins and minerals are often in different combinations in fruit and vegetables that we haven't yet discovered yet is important. I think that's probably another good thing to think about, is that nature has this innate knowledge of what works and what our bodies actually need that us as humans probably have no idea about yet. Like, our actual knowledge of the human body is pretty rudimentary. Like, what we'll know in 100,000 years time will be so amazing compared to what we know now. And so things like the combination of phytonutrients and vitamins and minerals, essential fatty acids and fiber and food is actually really complex. And it's likely the interaction of those compounds that are found in foods that's responsible for a lot of their health benefits, as opposed to one single nutrient or one or two nutrients. Like, I'm thinking one example of this, and I know that it's not that relevant to PCOS, but I think it's a good example anyway, is that quite a few years ago they found that tomatoes were really important for prostate health, and that we could potentially reduce the risk of prostate cancer, I think it was, due to increasing tomato consumption in men. And so supplement companies went, wow, awesome. What is it about tomatoes that is potentially the active ingredient that we could isolate and just give that in high doses, and maybe we could potentially wipe out prostate cancer through this? They found that one important and like compound in tomatoes is something called lycopene. And so they extracted that out. They then did studies on lycopene supplements, and they found that they had nowhere near the same impact as actually consuming tomatoes. And that is because of all the other things that are in tomatoes that complement the lycopene and, as you said, Charlie, make it more bioavailable, make it actually absorbable by us, but also too means that it's actually probably doing the work as opposed to just that one nutrient doing the work.
Exactly. I think there's so much that we still have to learn about the human body and all of these amazing things like vegetables that which nature has for us to help optimize our health and make us feel great, where unfortunately manufactured foods just hasn't been able to replicate that.
Yeah, and that's another good one, because you can get fiber products. So when we're talking about fiber and vegetables, you could just think, well, why don't we just take why don't I just have my mac and cheese with my Metamucil?
Yeah, exactly. And we were talking about this just before, and one thing that we don't sort of look further into, especially with some of these fiber products, and I think we can probably put green and reds powders into this category as well, is what are the added ingredients? So when we're talking about that, it's obviously not just going to be fiber, like with Metamucil, for example, we know that that is made from something called psyllium husk. But what else is in there? Have you ever thought to potentially look? Because the second ingredient is actually a artificial sweetener called aspartame, which is probably not something that you want to include daily into your diet. And especially some of these greens and reds powders have a lot of added ingredients, particularly sugar or flavors or things to make them taste nice, because not a lot of them actually are that tasty, and you may not want to have them otherwise.
Yeah, that's so true. psyllium. I've had just a lot of plain psyllium husk in my life, and it's not that palatable.
No,
it's not. It's but also, too, interestingly, is that often these fibre products make people a lot bloated, and whereas, I mean, vegetables can for some people too, but probably not to the same extent as a really big whack of like psyllium husk, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there's, yeah, often artificial colours, flavours. So if you are one of these people that potentially does regularly take Metamucil, I encourage you to have a look at the ingredients on the back, and hopefully a couple of tips that we're going to go through soon might give you some better ways to increase your fibre and see if that helps keep you regular instead of relying on something like Metamucil.
Yeah, definitely. The other thing is that, again, going back to that bulk, this is where fibre supplements fall down as well. I think they're a good, some of them are a really good addition to get even more fibre into your diet. But they, like if you think about a sachet of Metamucil that you put into some water, if you just had that for your lunch, there's no way that's going to keep you full, right? Whereas if you had the same amount of fibre from a bowl of vegetables, it would be quite a big bowl of vegetables, then how full are you compared to that? Right, like you're gonna be full from that. And so I think we need to think about fiber supplements as that, a supplement. Really helpful, get the right type, we'll talk about that a little bit, but they can't be a replacement. Same thing with the athletic powders, right? Like, you know, I wouldn't say the brand name, but the reds and greens powders that you can buy, often full of sugar. As you said, Charlie, some of them are full of artificial, like literally artificial sweeteners, not even kind of good natural sweeteners like monk fruit or something like that, but actually artificial sweeteners. And are just not going to keep you full. You're going to end up snacking and having another meal. That's often probably, again, if you're not eating vegetables, probably going to be a high carbohydrate meal. That along with that drink that's potentially got a whole bunch of sugar in it as well.
Yeah, exactly. I think it comes back to that. How can we get that bulk, that volume, that fiber to help keep us full? And then also looking out for our insulin, what's going to keep our blood sugar the most stable, which are two, yeah, really important and key parts for us with PCOS.
Yeah. So that's the kind of why. I guess the next thing is why, what are the most common reasons people find vegetables difficult? And as we said at the start, this is no judgment. This is really common. It's very natural, you know, when you've come from those highly palatable, refined foods, things like vegetables, the texture, the taste can be really off-putting. So what do you think, based on our patients, would be the main reason for not liking them or finding them difficult?
Yeah, I think a big thing actually is taste, and I don't know if that's come from preconceived ideas of what veggies taste like or bad childhood experiences. Like, I know my dad still goes on about how he can't stand Brussels sprouts, even if I roast them really nicely and put a dressing over the top, because all he can think about was my beautiful grandmother and her boiled Brussels sprouts that she used to force feed them as a child. And so he still can't stand them. So
yeah. My mum's the same with broad beans, like the big floury broad beans, or her other one is mashed parsnip and carrot together. So like, even like, I don't think I tried a broad bean until I was in my 20s, because I'd never been exposed to them, because she hated them, so we never grew them or cooked them.
Same with me and Brussels sprouts. Didn't have it until I was working in a cafe and restaurant at university.
Yeah.
Well, they were fried and probably not that great for you, but yeah, we just never had them. So that's just one example from, or two examples from us with not having exposure to them, or childhood experiences, or even from our parents that have been passed down, which have got rid of that. So that definitely does come back to that sort of taste. So it could be that it's a bit bitter, or I think the bitterness is quite a big one, especially with greens and leafy greens and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the, when we're thinking Brussels sprouts, that's definitely the thing that I think would be off-putting about that, is like quite bitter. And maybe the texture though, when you boil them, like mushy, yeah, that could be a definite one. And we go on to texture next, but I think that texture is often a really big one as well. It's like where they're overcooked or having too much raw, being brought up on too much raw food, and then feeling like you're just having to chew heaps and not really enjoying the taste of that could also be a big thing too.
Yeah, totally. It could be either end of the spectrum, overcooking and having that mushy. No judgment at all, but personally not my favorite. Some people love really mushy overcooked broccoli. I can't stand that, but it comes down to your personal preference. So some people do just prefer different things, and that's totally fine. Sometimes you just have to experiment and see what suits you best. But I think texture aversions are a lot more common than what we think.
Oh, yeah. I think I've talked about it on the podcast before, but I had a really severe texture aversion when I was a child. So anything mushy from when I was about, I think it happened when I was about 4 years old. Like before that, I would be totally fine with anything like porridge or what else we call porridge? It's porridge is quite a like New Zealand term. Oatmeal.
Oats? Yeah.
Oatmeal, yeah. Totally fine with that. Basically, literally it was sort of like an overnight, woke up and had a really severe gag reflex to that. Like as soon as it hit my tongue, I would gag. And so that would be the same with anything mushy. So yes, mushy broccoli would have been like worst nightmare for me as well. Like mushy Brussels sprouts, mashed potato, anything like that would hit my tongue and I'd immediately gag. And I grew out of it. It wasn't until I was about 18. It took a long time, but grew out of it. But it came back in pregnancy in my second trimester, very interestingly. And not first trimester, but second trimester. And so I totally resonate with the texture thing. Like texture is a really big problem for me. It's much better now, but I still, if it's going to be anything, it's never going to be about taste. It's always going to be about texture for me.
Yeah, it's such an interesting one. I personally have never had any texture aversions and hopefully won't, but my brother definitely has, so it's something I've grown up knowing about. Same, can't do like cooked mushy vegetables, but more when it's been roasted, so like roasted eggplant or roasted courgette or zucchini, or even if it's grated in spaghetti bolognese or something like that. The texture, or wilted spinach, he calls it soggy, that's the texture that he describes it as. Can't stand it, so it's always, yeah, an interesting one of, okay, how can I make this crispy, or what can I do to get around it so that it doesn't have that soggy texture, as he says.
Yeah, exactly, and I think that's the big thing, is that, I mean, I still, my parents were quite... definitely wanted me to eat like a variety of foods and things like that, so we just had to work out different ways of doing this. So if they were going to have mashed potato, then they would just remove the potato from the pot for me before they mashed it. Totally fine, not a problem at all. I could deal with that, and I think that's the thing that we have to do now as adults, is go, right, I just need to find a way that I enjoy this, and it sometimes can be a trial and error, but generally there is a way that we can enjoy most, or at least start with the easy kind of ones that we are more likely to enjoy, right? As well, instead of just saying, I don't do vegetables, it's like, cool, okay, let's find ones that are going to be the most palatable and start with them first, rather than the ones like, I would say that Brussels, I mean, lots of people love Brussels sprouts, but I would say they're it's touch and go with those, like whether you like them or not.
I would agree.
It can be quite polarizing as a vegetable.
Yeah, and especially some of the more bitter tasting greens, potentially like kale or something like rocket or arugula.
Yeah,
it's just got that a little bit more of a pronounced taste, I guess, which some people love, but for other people, maybe not the best thing to start with.
Yeah, compared to something like a baby spinach, which is quite benign and tastes like quite neutral tasting, right?
Yeah, exactly. We can look at I guess actually a lot of veggies have a high water content, but the super high water content veggies like zucchini or cauliflower, which can sort of eat more easily be masked with their flavor. Yeah.
That's an interesting one though, because I also think that no flavor is also quite a big reason why people don't like vegetables.
Yes, actually, very good point. I guess in that before with my example was meaning how can we mask it in things? So meaning we would be adding or using other flavor to sort of like hide it. Whereas I think just having a bowl of steamed zucchini and then cauliflower, probably not that nice. Not a lot of flavor in there.
No, exactly. Yeah. So I think that's probably another reason is, and when we're going through these things, maybe just think about that, because generally I think that it's childhood associations that generally cause this aversion to vegetables. And so maybe thinking about, like, either for you, maybe it was complete non-exposure to vegetables or very limited exposure. So that can be another one too. And then when you've tried eating them as adults, you just, you know, you don't really like the flavor or the texture. But sometimes it is a bad sort of childhood experience as well. And so maybe think back, what is it about that you didn't like? So was it texture? Was it the bitterness? Was it the no flavor? Or also the other one, and we've recently done an episode on this too, Charlie, is bloating. And that's what I brought up before about the fiber, but is that a lot of vegetables can be quite gassy for a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. Which you can sort of alleviate and help your body out, like what I was saying before, with like massaging the kale and sort of breaking it down, because raw kale can be really rough on your gut, especially if your gut is going through a bit of a hard time or if you are more prone to this bloating. So there are definite ways that you can help yourself out and reduce this bloating. And I know that I shared it on that podcast, but raw onion is something that really sets me off. So I know raw onion is not for me. So it either has to be cut up really small or cooked really well so that I can digest it a bit better, because sometimes there are just triggers or different ways that you can prepare things that don't work 100% for you. And that's totally okay. Yeah. And comes back to the trial and error that you said before. So it might take a couple of different recipes or meals or ways of preparing things for you to 100% figure out what works best for you. But it's giving it a go and giving it a chance and trusting yourself to see what works and how we can make it work for you so that you can include all sorts of delicious vegetables and flavor into your meals.
Yeah, definitely. So I think have listened to that prior episode that we did. Sorry, I can't tell you what episode it's going to be because we haven't actually released it yet. We've just recorded that one. But we did do one on bloating. So I think the main thing there is if you're avoiding vegetables because a lot of them cause bloating for you, then have a listen to that podcast episode, because that will give you a way through with actually fixing the cause of the bloating so that then you can tolerate a lot more vegetables as well.
Yeah, and I'd say just a general tip so that you've got something from this podcast regarding bloating and veggies as well. Most of the time would be cooking veggies or steaming them. So it doesn't have to be that overboiled, like we said, but I generally cooking or steaming vegetables and just having that slightly softer texture can be a bit easier on the gut. Or if it's a leafy green like kale, massaging some of the leaves down, or just making sure you chew it really well would be a quick tip.
Yeah, and what are the other vegetables that are less on the bloating scale? So like a lot of the bloating ones would be it's called a family of vegetables called the brassica family, like the cabbage. This is why cabbage gets a bad rap for being gassy, but cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli and kale. Kale's brassica too. Yeah, kale's brassica. They are probably ones that you would leave for now. But things like carrots tend to be really well tolerated by most people, even with like IBS bloating symptoms. Zucchini.
Yeah, generally bell peppers or capsicums.
Yep. There's lots of other ones.
Spinach, iceberg lettuce or any green lettuce like that is usually okay as well.
Yeah. So I'd say start with the easy ones too. Easy ones, and then the other kind of more likely culprits, steam or cook them. Stir fry is another kind of good way.
Yeah, stir fry is a great way. Tomato is usually fine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good idea.
Lots of options.
So that's going back to those that the reason for dislike is more the flavor or texture. Let's talk about some things that you could do if that's the case for you to start getting you into vegetables. So I think probably the best way to start is by really finely chopping, blending or blitzing them, so that, because that generally gets over the texture part, right?
Yeah, totally. Blending or blitzing veggies is a great way. And also because it breaks down a lot of the veggies and makes it a lot smaller. So it's a good way to not only get in or sort of mask that texture, but to pack in a whole heap of veggies with other flavors, because you're going to be adding this to your meal. So we're not saying, oh, why don't you just go and take a whole lot of veggies and put them in your blender and there you go, there's your meal. We'll talk about it in a second, but it's how can you blend them into potentially recipes or meals that you're already making that you already like, so that we can mask them and make it a little bit more nutritious. And it doesn't have to be gung-ho all at once, let's add in half of the veggie shop. Like, maybe it is just picking one, or if you're feeling adventurous, picking two veggies to blitz together and seeing how that goes.
Yeah, what's an example of that? I'm just trying to think, like, the easiest, like, ones to start with to give some people an idea of, like, what we're talking about here.
Yeah, so I think a fantastic one is zucchini, which we've mentioned a couple of times, which is a very versatile veggie. So I know that one of your favorite things to do with zucchinis is chopping them up, popping them in a bag in the freezer and using it in your smoothies. So that's maybe not something you've heard of before, but
it's so good. Like, people always look at me funny when I say this, and I wrote it in my book, Getting Pregnant with PCOS. I put a recipe in there for this, and the amount of people that have contacted me and said, I love your zucchini smoothie, is like, you would be really surprised. It's literally, we get a weekly person who we see that says, oh my God, I still have your zucchini smoothie from the book. And the reason being is that you can't taste it. It's not like adding, because I don't add other vegetables like spinach and stuff, because I'm like, man, my protein powder at the moment is salted caramel flavor. I don't want salted caramel and spinach, like a bitter taste. It just does not work. Like, those tastes don't work together. And so whereas zucchini is tasteless, it takes on the taste of what you're putting it with. So it is, and the frozen element means that it's then nice and cold.
And thick.
And thick, yeah. So it's really nice and like thick and cold, and you don't even taste the zucchini, you just taste the like whatever flavor you've got in there. So that's a really good one. But you could also do it in like a pasta sauce. Like, I'm just thinking, last night we made one for our family, with including my 1-year-old Florence, where I grated some zucchini and put it with a tomato sauce, and we had some meatballs and some pasta. And that was a really good way of getting it into, because essentially children are the same, you know, like, they don't really, a lot of them don't love vegetables, the texture, the taste. And so hiding it in foods, or like blending them into foods, can be a really good way of getting that in without them having to physically eat a zucchini.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're like my brother and you don't like the texture of the grated zucchini, just pop it in a blender. So you could steam it first or do it raw, and then pop it in with your tomato sauce that you're making. So that could go in a tomato pasta sauce. So I know that we've been bagging a little bit on this pre-prepared mac and cheese food, but if you're regularly having pasta, that's okay. Let's see how we can make this a bit more nutritious, and maybe we just start with blending up a bit of zucchini and adding it into your pasta sauce. Or, like you said, meatballs, another fantastic way to get a bit more volume and bulk into your meatballs. So I personally love grating my zucchini in, but you can potentially blend it and add it in that way as well. Or if you're open to trying it grated, I haven't had texture aversions, but I don't notice the texture. It's still pretty soft to me.
No, yeah, it's pretty soft.
You'd agree.
Yeah, same thing. Grating in like carrot and stuff into meatballs, or into like a bolognese or a chili con carne is a really good thing too. Any like ground beef or minced meat is a really good one for adding things into, because
definitely
it's already, it is the perfect kind of texture for doing that, because it's already kind of crumbled, like ground, you know, so you can add stuff in there. Whereas like trying to you know, put some grated carrot into a steak just doesn't work, because you can't, like, what are you going to do? Like, try and like create a hole in it and stuff it in. So anything that you can think of that you would make from ground beef, or doesn't have to be ground beef, but it could be ground, or even like a scrambled tofu, or like broken up kind of tempeh.
Definitely.
Or any other meat. So like ground pork or chicken or turkey would also be great. Like, we often make these Vietnamese or Thai inspired chicken kind of meatballs with ground chicken, and then also we add in some like lemongrass flavor and some a little bit of chili, and then some grated carrot and some like chopped up bell peppers and like lots of other vegetables like that. So that works in really well, and then you're adding the other flavor of like the, so it's not just like, because ground chicken is quite tasteless, so if you just put that with your other veggies you'd probably taste it, but if you're putting in like curry paste or like lemongrass, that gives it the extra flavor that it takes on, so that you're tasting that as opposed to really tasting the taste of the vegetables.
Exactly. We're wanting to mask it here so that you're not averse to the flavor. So it's like, we want you to taste the salted caramel smoothie. We want you to enjoy your beautiful Vietnamese meatballs rather than getting the taste of the veggies if that's something you don't like.
Yeah.
And I think another sort of easy win is potentially adding grated carrot or zucchini into baked goods. So sometimes it can go into something like a banana bread or a carrot loaf. So that's just another small win where can we make something a little bit more nutritious that's maybe something that you're already having or already making?
Yeah, that's a really good idea. One that I really love, and we use heaps because we're just growing so many zucchinis at the moment. I know we're talking about zucchini a lot, but it is a really good one to start with because it is so bland in flavor. Is making a quiche or a zucchini quiche or zucchini bread. So basically it's just ground up zucchini, lots of eggs that are scrambled up, a bit of onion, a bit of garlic. You can put some bacon in there if you want to. I think that bacon would add a bit more extra kind of saltiness and flavor, would be a really good addition there if you are a meat eater. And it is so good because it gives us really good protein and really good, like, you know, good whack of zucchini from your vegetables as well.
Exactly. And I think a couple of other things that you could potentially do it with your smoothie. I know that frozen cauliflower florets is another way. So there's an alternative option there.
And I think that cauliflower is a lot more known about now because there's been basically an explosion of cauliflower products on the market for a while. I would just say, though, that a lot of the manufactured cauliflower products that you find out there aren't actually that much cauliflower. Like, you look at many of the cauliflower pizza bases at the supermarket and you'll find that there might be 10% of cauliflower in them, right? It's certainly
so
not...
So sneaky.
So sneaky.
Clever marketing. Yeah. Tricking us.
I'm just thinking of one particular brand that we can get in New Zealand, and it is marketed as a cauliflower pizza base, and the actual amount of cauliflower in it is tiny. The
is
top
10%,
ingredient.
8%? Yeah. I looked the other day.
Top ingredient by far is flour, is wheat. So just be a little bit careful about those, but you can definitely take that concept and also make it yourself if you can't, you know, like if you want to find one. So you can make a cauliflower pizza base, but it just is, it's probably not quite as like crispy as the one you'll get from the supermarket.
It's not going to be an artisan sourdough pizza, unfortunately, but still a great, an alternative.
Yeah, but also too, you don't have to just do that. You don't have to, you know, like suddenly everything becomes vegetables. You can still use a normal pizza base, but instead put on heaps of vegetable toppings would be my alternative. So I would instead use like a low carb tortilla wrap and have that as my base, and then put on like mushrooms or like bell, depends what flavor I'm going for, but like artichoke, really good.
Yeah,
like I love like a smoked chicken and artichoke and rocket pizza, brocket, as we talked about before, arugula, like a little bit more peppery, so maybe not your first step into vegetables, but like artichoke, really delicious and quite flavorless, so not a repulsive flavor or a polarizing flavor.
Yeah, and if it's something that you haven't tried before, quite often they come in a can or in a jar, and the brine can be a bit more flavorful, I find. So just give it a quick rinse. Just a quick tip with the artichokes, I reckon, just give it a quick rinse so that the brine isn't so intense that that's not a flavor you like, because artichokes are delicious.
Yeah, really, really good. Really good in a dip too, just with a bit of olive oil, and like you could use that like even with some, like, again, so like a low carb tortilla, make that into chips and then have that as like a artichoke dip.
Yeah, yum.
Just a bit of olive oil and salt.
If you're open to it and if you like them, great with veggie sticks like celery, carrot, bell peppers.
Yeah, amazing. So those are some things. I would say that cauliflower, though, going back to that, really good for adding in, as said, to like smoothies, adding like maybe substituting out some of your, like if you're doing like a macaroni cheese, you could do macaroni and cauliflower. So you could do like a half-half.
Yeah.
Would be really good.
Great idea. And another one is steaming pumpkin or squash and using that in a mac and cheese sauce. Because if you think about like pumpkin or mashing it, super creamy. So maybe it's not totally getting rid of your cheese sauce because that's also pretty yum. But yeah. Half and half, do half with mashed pumpkin. Yes, the color might be a little bit bright orange, but cool. We love color. Yeah. Add it in. Give it a try.
We often do that in lasagna. So we'll add in the pumpkin puree into the like the cheese sauce and then have that as like the layering in the lasagna.
That is a great idea. I love that. I've got a friend who does a delicious vegetarian lasagna and she does like thin strips of pumpkin through it. So sometimes I do that in a beef lasagna, but I love the idea of pureeing it and having it as part of the cheesy sauce.
Yeah,
I'm going to
really
do that.
Yummy. It's really, really good. And I think that's the other things too is like the other thing we haven't really talked about is using more like stronger flavors to probably just take over the taste. Like if you like choosing a flavor that you love and then adding some of those less flavorful or less, especially if you don't like really, really don't like the bitter flavors, then choosing these ones like the cauliflower and the zucchini and the pumpkin and carrots even, I would say, is like less flavorful and adding those in. So if you love tomato sauce, then, okay, cool. So your things like tomatoey pasta, tomatoey like meatballs, lasagnas, anything that you kind of gravitate towards, that's where you could then blitz, grate, shred, whatever of those.
Finely chop,
whatever of those lower flavor, like less bitter vegetables and pop them in there. Whether if it's more like you like the like cheesy kind of flavors, again, same thing. You could find the cheese, like again, macaroni cheese, we talked about that, swapping that out for like a half-half with cauliflower and doing that as well. Given that cauliflower cheese is, you know, a really common thing, you could even decide, okay, well, tonight we're actually going to just try cauliflower cheese instead of adding the macaroni as well. But maybe a first step would be adding the macaroni to that too. And if it's like, or if you're up for any different flavors, you could try adding, like we said before, the Asian flavors to meatballs to give them some flavor. Because maybe the one thing as well is that it's not just that you don't like the bitter flavors, but you actually just don't like the fact that previously they've been vegetables have been boring. Like if you grew up in very much a meat and three veg household, which is a very common New Zealand thing, a lot of us grew up with, and many of you in the rest of the world, but we had maybe boiled potatoes, some boiled broccoli, some boiled carrots and some peas and your like piece of steak, then you might think of vegetables as quite boring, which in that context they really are, and that certainly wouldn't be something that I'd be gravitating towards eating much ever, actually. Never. It would never ever happen for me. Like I would never think about boiling some broccoli or some carrots. Like it's just something that I don't enjoy, wouldn't eat, so I wouldn't make it. But I do use those vegetables heaps, but I might use them in like a stir fry with like Asian sauces to make it a lot more palatable, you know, tasteful and interesting. Or I might use them, as I said before, in like a tomatoey flavor or Mediterranean. And so sometimes it's about finding those flavors that you like and then really leaning on those and finding recipes that you really enjoy with those flavors.
Yeah, exactly. How can we jazz up veggies and make them exciting? Especially if the reason that you don't like them is because you found them boring, because you have only really had boiled ones before. It's like, all right, let's find something that makes them a bit more fun and exciting. So is there a beautiful drizzle of lemon olive oil that you can serve over the top with some salt and some nuts and seeds? Or yeah, what can we stir fry them in so that you like them? What kind of meals are you making at the moment and how can we incorporate some veggies into that so that it actually is something that maybe you're already familiar with? So there's like a bit of a lower barrier to entry, I guess, because we don't want to scare ourselves and have something that's totally different or new, because that you might already have your walls up. No, don't like this. This is a new meal, new veggies. So it's looking at what are you doing now and how can we incorporate or add something in with something that you do like and something that is palatable and tastes nice to you?
Yeah. One way that I do this is I just ask people, I say, when you get takeaways, what's your go-to? And that then generally like tells me where their flavor preferences are. So is it like Mexican? Is it Italian? Is it Thai? Is it Indonesian? Is it whatever it is? And then you can go, right, like, okay, so of that kind of country of origin or flavor of origin, what are the other foods that do incorporate a lot more vegetables? Or what are the flavors? So if it's Mexican, then there's a lot of like lime and like chili and cumin and
paprika.
Yeah, those kind of flavors, and go, okay, cool. So let's find other recipes with those in there, and then maybe Google maybe top chefs from the area. Like if it's Mediterranean, then like Ottolenghi is like a really common one that, or kind of more Middle Eastern, I would say, for him. But
he's got a lot of great veggie recipes.
Yeah,
so
really good.
Although don't let it freak you out, because there are quite a lot of ingredients in a lot of his recipes. Yeah. I was going to say, go and have a look for some inspiration, but some of his recipes, or all of his recipes, are amazing, but some of them do have some pretty exotic ingredients.
Yeah.
So don't get too freaked out. That's my only tip with his recipes.
So true, yeah. So true. Like, not everyone has sumac in their like cupboard. I do now. I actually really like
it. So do I.
But not everyone does. And so, yeah, it can be a bit off-putting. But that's kind of where I start, is like, where do our like natural kind of flavor preferences lie? And then you can find foods and flavors that like fit in with that. And then the other thing would be, just as I said, if it's like hiding kind of vegetables in there, or even if it's not hiding it in, putting it like on pizzas and other areas as well. And then, you know, adding those other more kind of dominant flavors to you know, protect that. The thing with the other part is the texture thing. And I think this is where we kind of need to talk about different ways of like cooking vegetables so that they're a better flavor. Because that example before of like the boiled broccoli, boiled carrots, boiled peas, two things going on there why they're boring. One, no flavor, but one, also no variety in the texture. And I think this is a really important thing to enjoy vegetables too. We've got to have that variety of texture. We've got to have crunchiness, like which we might get from not just raw, but like stir fried is a really good idea, where you're slightly cooking it. It's getting a little bit of that caramelization from the bottom of the pan. And so there's got a bit of flavor there, but also still a bit of crunchiness that it's not going to be mushy or
as George's word, soggy.
Yeah, soggy, yeah, not soggy. So those are things. And the air fryer is another one, you know, like roasting or like kind of frying it in the air fryer, another good way, adding that kind of crispiness and caramelization to it is, A, it gives it a lot of flavor from that, but also to a lot of good texture from the crispiness too, especially if it's something like mushy, what you might find more mushy, like pumpkin, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Making How can it, we get that crisp?
Yeah, roasted or in the air fryer, it makes it nice and crisp. One example I had, we talked about last week, I'm not a huge fan of eggplant or aubergine.
Same with George.
Yeah. And so we talked, Emma, Charlie and I talked about this last week, because I had a couple of eggplants and we're talking about ways that you could do it. And what I ended up doing was actually, I fried it in the air fryer and then I made a tamarind coconut yogurt like dipping sauce, and it was really good.
Yum.
Really, really yum. So that definitely for me, because it's definitely it's the mushiness I don't like. Mushiness in the seeds, it's kind of not a good combination for me. So frying it in the air fryer, you could do as well as like, even again, a really good start would just be like putting it in some breadcrumbs to make it like a or a bit of corn flour to make it more sort of tempura.
Yeah, exactly. And Emma's fantastic tip, which she shared with us, was lightly salting the eggplant and leaving it to sit if you can for 15 minutes. So if you've got time, but even just 5 minutes sitting is totally fine. And what that does is the salt draws out some of the water, and you just pat it with either a clean tea towel or a paper towel if you've got one. And we're just wanting to bring some of that water out of it so that when you do go and cook it, it's not going to have that soggy, mushy texture.
And it does crisp up.
It does.
Yeah. And that's what I did last week when I was making it in the air fryer. And yeah, that's a good idea. Like literally that was most of our meal. We had, I think it was like a Thursday night. We got home from work, friend popped round. we had a drink, we had some like snacks, and then and one of the snacks that I made was like these fried eggplants with tamarind coconut dipping like sauce. It was really good.
That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it was really, really good. So that is another really important thing, is just try to vary the cooking method that you're using to get different textures, because then that's a really common reason why you might not be liking them in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, there's so many different ways you can prepare veggies, whether it's, roasting, air fryer, even just a quick pan fry, even just a blanch or a steam. So if you've had boiled veggies before and they've sat on the stove on full go for 15 minutes, probably not that nice. How about giving it 3 to 5 minutes at a quick little blanch and seeing how that, or depending on the veggie and how you've cut it up, seeing how that goes, or even a slight blanch and then tossing it into a pan with some nice tasting nuts and seeds or some different herbs and spices, so that it gets something a little bit different.
And a really good way to quickly steam, if you are not opposed to using a microwave, is just putting it in a bowl in the microwave with a little bit of water on the bottom. Like, I'm talking, I don't know, a couple of tablespoons of water on the bottom. Putting a cover on it so that it does actually steam, and it literally a couple of minutes in the microwave. And then you could like drain that extra water out, and then have like a little bit of oil already heating in a pan so that's quite nice and hot, or in a wok, and then pop it straight into the wok so it gets that crispiness or the caramelization as well, and then adding in like your nuts and seeds or your dressing. Then if you're going to do, I don't know, like even if it was like a soy sauce and soy and honey kind of dressing, or with maybe even a little bit of sesame oil. So that's a really
good combo.
One that I would do would be like maybe like a quarter of a cup of soy sauce, a teaspoon of sesame oil, and a teaspoon of honey, and then if you like it and you can tolerate it, a couple of cloves of garlic, and then just put them all into an empty jar that you've got and shake that up, and then put that straight into the vegetables in the wok to give it a soy based sauce for kind of a Thai or Asian style flavor. If you don't like soy sauce, or you can't tolerate soy, or you're gluten intolerant, then tamari sauce or coconut aminos would be a good spot for that.
Yeah, and if you are not opposed to the mushy, more well-cooked veggies, another great way, especially during winter time, or if this is something that you like to do to prep in advance, is adding some extra veggies to things like crock pot or slow-cooked meals. Mm. So I know that anytime I do one, it ends up being almost double the size of what it should be, because every veggie from my veggie drawer that can be cooked usually goes in there for many reasons. Variety, great way to use veggies that otherwise maybe need to be used, and it takes on all of the flavor from what you're slow cooking, because usually with what I'm doing, it sort of sits in the slow cooker or in our cast iron in the oven for 4 or 5 hours. So it takes on all of that beautiful flavor from what you're cooking, and can be a variety of different things. So sometimes, I might do more of like an Indian style curry, or like a Thai style with a green curry paste, or I might use a paprika, more Mexican type spice mix if I'm doing like a piece of meat, and there's just veggies go around the outside, and it's totally fine.
Such a good idea. Curries especially, I think, is such a good one we haven't talked about, but they like so easy to cook, so easy to disguise the flavor. You can change the consistency of the texture of the vegetables just on like whether you add them in at the start or whether you add them in close to the end. Close to the end, they're going to be a bit more crispy.
Yeah, key tip there. If you don't like them mushy and you're used to having, and you would like them in a curry, just put them through halfway or two-thirds into cooking. So don't add them in at the beginning if that's what the recipe says. Let's have them a little bit more crunchy. Totally fine for things like carrots, bell peppers, broccoli, zucchini. Yum.
Yeah, beans. Totally. Or even, if you're even more worried about that, then just do the microwave trick and then just add them in before you serve.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So many different ways. And I think that the main thing is just don't be afraid to try things. Yes, it might not work, but just the common, and I use this not because I want to treat anyone like a child, but when you're introducing a child to new tastes and flavors and textures, The general rule is that you have to give that to them 10 times before they will accept that. And so if we think about that, that all we're doing is now trying to introduce our palate to something new, it's likely going to take us a long time. Probably I would say the exact same amount of time, at least 10 tries before you're actually going to, you know, like that. So if you try something and you don't like it, maybe it's just try it again, but in a different way, or keep exposing. And it might be that you don't cook a big portion to start with. It might be like one or two broccoli florets. And then do that, but do that every week. You know, you can say, okay, I don't have to have a whole bowl, but I just need to try one floret. And then do that over 10 weeks. And by the end of that, your body will likely accept that a lot, you know, or almost accept it entirely, if not actually start to enjoy that.
That's a great way to do it. Even if it is, yeah, like you said, once a week for 10 weeks, I think that's a very achievable thing to add in, just one small thing your week. Be brave, take a step.
Yeah, and just realize that you're probably not going to have success the first time. Just keep trying it, and eventually you'll be like, oh yeah, this isn't actually so bad.
You might surprise yourself. You might really enjoy them.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing, is that that's literally how our taste buds develop. And so you eventually you will. Like, that is, it's pretty much guaranteed that that's the way our taste buds develop. So keep going with it and keep trying things, and just keep trying to enjoy different ways of actually having them.
Now stand by for our disclaimer. The information contained in this podcast has been prepared for the purpose of providing information, including about the PCOS Nutritionist products and services, and is designed to support clients' overall wellness. It is not intended to provide medical advice or designed to rectify, treat, or cure any specific medical conditions or diseases. Nothing stated or shared in our podcast is intended to be and must not be taken to be medical advice. Please seek the advice of professionals as appropriate regarding the evaluation of any specific information, opinion, advice, or content contained in our podcast.